Welcome to the Educause podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Real Networks and features a session from the Educause 2008 annual conference. Participants include David Antonacci, Director of Teaching and Learning Technologies at the University of Kansas Medical Center, and Stephanie Gerald, Educational Technologist at the University of Kansas Medical Center. This session is entitled Teaching Nurse Anesthesia in a Second Life Operating Room Simulation.
Okay, thank you, Al, and welcome to our presentation to talk a little bit about a project that we did with our nurse anesthesia department, where we designed, developed usability testing for an operating room simulation, and then also how you can take what we did and possibly apply it to some of the work that you do. Talk a little bit about the context. First, University of Kansas is in Lawrence. That's the main campus. About 30,000 students go there. We're at the Medical Center, which is in Kansas City, Kansas, and we have about 3,500 of those 30,000 students. We're right next to the University of Kansas Hospital. Within the University of Kansas Medical Center are three schools: School of Medicine, School of Allied Health, and School of Nursing. And what I quickly learned was if it wasn't medicine or nursing, it must be in allied health. So there's probably, 15 or so programs and certificates that are grouped in there. And one of those is our nurse anesthesia education program. And I've never asked why nurse anesthesia wasn't in the School of Nursing, but I think that there was some political stuff going on many years ago when it was being formed. So for some reason, it ended up in the School of Allied Health. And then our department, Teaching and Learning Technologies, at the Medical Center, we have about 10 people in the department. Most of the people are masters prepared with backgrounds in educational technology, instructional design, media, and we have three bachelor's prepared e-learning specialists that help us with development of some of the content, and one of the specialists did some of the work on this project in Second Life. Rather than spend a lot of time about the technical capabilities, we were at AJ's presentation this morning, and something like 90% of the people already had an avatar in Second Life. So let's do a real quick poll. Who has an avatar already in Second Life? Okay, all but three people. No, there's a few more than that. Real quickly, some of the technical capabilities that are there. You have an avatar which can move and animate on there. There's social networking, which is an important aspect about it. You can text chat and voice chat. There's groups that you can join. There's a multimedia aspect where you can play streaming video, streaming audio. Building and scripting is an important part that the entire world is created by its users. Complex objects are created and scripted. And there's land and economy also that's available. And I think that's really the distinctive aspects about Second Life. First is the multi-user aspect of it, and it's user-created. That distinguishes it from some of the other games that are out there where you're playing in an already created world, already created universe. Those technical capabilities are fine, but what a lot of people want to know about, how do those translate into educational possibilities? And that's some of the work that our department has been doing. Nellie Moderis and I have done some studies on educational possibilities, did a presentation back in 2005 at the Educause Southwest Regional where we introduced a model for teaching in Second Life. So some of the possibilities, one is simply a study of the virtual technology itself. That was probably the first educational use of Second Life. Fits in well. We had a group in our nurse informatics program that wanted to learn about virtual worlds, so they sent some students in just to learn what they were, some optional activities, a scavenger hunt to go and visit some of the health and education-related areas in Second Life. That's a good use, but not really a lot of courses have use for that unless you're looking at emerging technologies or virtual worlds, gaming, those types of things. Another one, and this appeals to a lot of folks, is Second Life as a communication medium. So how do you do a lecture? How do you have a class? We did one project for a School of Nursing where the students, instead of doing a traditional paper or in-class presentation, we brought their PowerPoints into Second Life, and then invited folks from around the world to come, and just like a poster session at a conference, except you could meet with their avatars, look at their presentations, chat with them in the virtual world. So kind of expands that from just your classroom to the world of, in this case, nurse education and nurses, nursing students. But the area that we're most interested in is how do we use Second Life for virtual world learning activities. And again, we have a model out there. If you Google my name and Second Life or possibilities, it'll probably come up pretty quickly to find that presentation. And that's what our operating room simulation is, one of those types of activities. Real briefly, some of our work. We started using Second Life in 2004. It had just been out of beta. And I joined because I was so new in the department, I didn't know this guy was joking that he really thought we ought to go get avatars and play around in Second Life. So I was in there, it was only about 10,000 people playing Second Life at the time, and looked at it, thought there was really some potential for that, and so we began working on how we would do that, how you might get faculty to use Second Life. So that's been our primary research, is in-world learning activities. About a year and a half ago, we bought a private island, a KUMC Isle, and that solves a lot of the security and mature content and gambling and all those other things that you hear, nasty things going on in Second Life. We have our own island. We know everybody who's there. In order to get on the island, we have to know your real name and match it up to your avatar name. So it's a safe, secure place. People want to go off the island and do other things, that's fine with us. We didn't lock it down with that type of capability, although we could limit access both on and off the island, but we chose to let people go off the island. That was what faculty wanted. And then some of our projects, I talked about the scavenger hunt and the poster sessions. We have another one with nursing informatics. We built a community living center, and their students have to go into the center and design a database for the center, so they have to walk around, take a look at patient charts, take a look at the facilities, get a lot of visual cues as to what might need to be included in that database, and then the instructors pose as the director of the community living center, and they can interview them to get some ideas about what the database ought to do. Other project, and I don't know, we may do a presentation on this, or Steph probably writing an article on it already. A real cool one with our physical therapy, occupational therapy department. They do home assessments, so if you're, as my dad got older, he lost mobility, had to use a walker and eventually a wheelchair. A therapist came into our house, looked it over, told us where to put a handrail, how to work the bathtub, some of those kind of things. And our students need to learn that, and part of how they learn that now is in Second Life. They used to just evaluate their apartments, but that really wasn't that complicated of a place. Plus, the instructor didn't know what was there and what wasn't there. So we built a home and seated it with a bunch of known disability problems, one handrail, a rug as a trip hazard, doorknobs instead of levers, those types of things. And our students go in and then evaluate that home and write up the home assessment based on that information. So want to shift in that this project was one that came out of our nurse anesthesia program, and it started with a meeting about interactivity. This was my third meeting with this faculty member about how to add interaction to courses, and the first two, all my suggestions, she cheerfully ignored. This time she made an important comment. She says, "I want interaction without the discussion board." And I go, "Oh, I see. You want interactivity. You want to interact with a computer, not other people on there." And that's kind of a breakthrough on there. She was already aware of 3D simulations and mentioned that. And I mention it because everybody thinks that, since I'm such a big advocate of Second Life, that I started the conversation. But it was her idea first to go and do 3D simulations. We were already aware of Second Life, and so that moved us real quickly into at least demonstrating to her what Second Life could do, some of the things we were already doing at the time. And one thing that she mentioned is they were dissatisfied with SimMan. We have a very expensive simulator. I think it costs about $100,000, and you have to have pretty much a technician full-time to program and run it. So they don't get much time, actually, on the SimMan. And so that kind of formed the spark for the idea, maybe we could do something where we could use Second Life as a substitute for the SimMan. Got very complicated very quickly, And I think an important part of it, once we had that initial idea, we refined it down to a very simple, manageable project for the first project and left the other ones as revisions and other things we might do. So we decided that the students need to learn a very complex procedure called induction, and that basically patients wheeled into the operating room, and there's a very lengthy process that the nurse anesthetist has to go through before the surgeon actually starts cutting on you. I thought all you did is take a couple sucks off that mask and you woke up with your knee fixed, but they do all kinds of nasty stuff. They stick this thing down your throat and they tape your eyes closed, and it really very complicated, enough that I don't think I'll ever have surgery done again, even if I'm asleep through the whole thing. So it is very complicated, lots of variation in what they can do. So they need to learn this procedure before they actually go into a real operating room. They only get to do that with SimMan once they step through this procedure. That's kind of high demand simulator that we have in there. So we refined it to a realistic scope. We wanted them to learn the procedure, what to do when, not necessarily how to do intubation or how to tell if the electrodes are connected correctly, EKG electrodes are connected correctly, but just when to do them and approximately how to connect them. So we're not trying to simulate any kind of tactile feedback that they might get by actually manipulating the equipment. Some of the project objectives, big one for the students, of course, we learned the basic induction procedure. For us, we wanted to gain experience building and scripting, especially scripting some complex things. We also wanted to develop a new learning technique, and that's what we'll show you, and hopefully be able to apply some of that to what you do. And then last, and this was somewhat unintended, by how we designed the operating room, it really looks like a University of Kansas hospital operating room. So when the students walk into our simulated world, they're pretty much seeing what the operating room looks like in real life, and so they begin to learn where different things are located, where to find the pulse oximeter. It's hanging on the IV pole in our simulation because it's hanging on the IV pole in the real operating room. So they unintentionally, they learn some of those things just by being in world. And I'll turn this over to Stephanie.
So first of all, I have to apologize. I got kind of sick yesterday, and hopefully my voice carries and you can all hear me. If you can't hear me, please let me know. So we get asked a lot, why are we using Second Life with this? And one of the reasons is the low cost that it provides. All the students are able to go in and get a membership for free. We did buy the island, which is about $1,000 to set it up, and then there's a monthly fee as well, I believe. But it's fairly low cost, especially compared to the SimMan that they're doing, and they only get one chance to do the SimMan. There's rapid development, so we in our TLT department, we can go in there and quickly create objects and textures and load it in there and then script what it needs to do pretty rapidly. And also the secure space, Dave talked a little bit about that, where we have our island and only students that go to KU Medical Center are able to log in and go through, and we don't have grievers or anything like that coming around and messing with our stuff. So that's why we chose Second Life. So after we figured out the initial project, Dave and I actually got to scrub in. We got to go and go into the OR, and we had to wear the scrubs, and they took us through the entire process, so we got to watch exactly all the little tiny steps and what's going on. So we worked through the induction procedure, and this is one of the nurse anesthetist's faculty members there, Carrie, I think is her name. And we also took a lot of time and photographed most of the objects. We have to, and also photographed the textures so that we could place on the objects in Second Life. So from that, we actually developed the actual procedure. Now, this is a very just a very simple procedure that I typed up for these slides. Each one of these has actually a lot of things, complicated things that go in each one, like the airway assessment. We have to give the student a note card, actually, and the student has to know what to do with the note card and how to retrieve it when they need it for the future parts in the simulation. The pulse oximeter on the finger, they have to click on it, and then some other things happen in the simulation. And then also, like, step four here, the EKG, they have to know which lead to place where on the patient, and then the blood pressure cuff, step six there, they have to attach that, and then they also have to know which arm to put it on, and then they need to know to push the start screen, the start button on the main screen there. So these are the first 10 steps. Here are a few more steps there. Mask ventilation, giving gas. You have to check twitches, like they check to see if you're out and if you're twitching. And then they take the face mask away, and then they do the intubation process where the laryngoscope, which was the picture before that you saw, the little knife thing, as Dave calls it, they have to, we'll present them with a picture of the vocal cords, because they have to be able to see the vocal cords before they can put the laryngoscope in there, in the tube that goes in as well. And then that attaches to the squeeze bag, and they have to see the chest rise. So there's a lot of steps, as you can tell, and here's some more. They also have to check breath sounds with the stethoscope and the squeeze bag and make sure that the right and left lung, they hear breath sounds from both sides, because if they put the tube too far in or to the wrong side, then they know that they did it wrong. And then the stomach has no sounds. They have to make sure that the tube's not way down in the stomach and you're not getting the air. And then there's a whole thing with the ventilator, and they have to, like Dave said, tape your eyelids. I think that was earlier. Then they have to tape the endotracheal tube. So we went through and we learned this pretty well. It was very interesting. And then we end induction here. So we also had to look at what problems and solutions that we had to really look at. We had to determine if we wanted to buy objects that were already in Second Life or modify existing objects out there or build our own objects. And what we decided was to build our own, because when you buy objects, you don't always get the ability to copy them. You don't always get the ability to modify them in the way you want. So we wanted to start from scratch and build these objects so that we could manipulate them and do exactly what we wanted them to do without having to, you know, do some weird other thing with something that someone else made. The level of realism and functionality was very important as a student goes into the OR. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm kind of drugged up.
Level of realism and functionality. Anytime you do a simulation, how realistic is it going to look? And then what level of functionality are we going to script into the objects? Obviously, it can get incredibly complicated. We had to strike a blend between it being somewhat real and being us, our ability to actually make it.
Thank you, Dave. So we had to determine what kind of visual cues we actually wanted to give in the simulation. We didn't want to give too many visual cues where the student wouldn't actually learn the process. You know, they would just know what to do from the visual cues, but we had to have enough visual cues so that they knew how to get past the software. So they knew if our object looks a little different than the other one, they had to know that that is the blood pressure cuff and it doesn't look exactly like the one in the OR, then they needed to know that that's the blood pressure cuff. So we kind of give those kind of visual cues as well. We also thought that there would be a problem with life-sized objects and how a lot of the objects in the operating room are very small and, you know, they all fit in your hand, basically. And we were worried that most of the objects would be too small and it would be hard to click on, or the students wouldn't know where to, how to get to it, what to click on, and it'd be too far away, it'd be kind of difficult. But we did realize that that doesn't matter too much, which we'll talk about a little later. We also had to determine how to do some feedback to the user. So they need to know if they did click on the blood pressure cuff, whether that worked or that was applied to the patient there. They had to know as far as giving drugs. It was hard for us to show actually putting the syringe into the patient. So really we just have text cues saying when they click on something, how much drugs do you want to give, this much, and then it says you've just given the patient this much drugs. The performance evaluation, it took us a little bit to figure this out because in Second Life, we thought we could capture all what they're doing into a note card, but that isn't what... Sorry. That isn't something that we could do in Second Life. So what we had to do was figure out how to capture everything that was going on and email that to the instructor. Sorry. We also had to determine, it's a multi-user environment, so if there are two or three students in there trying to perform the simulation at once, what were we going to do with that? Are we going to have different stations where each student can have different things? Well, there's so many objects that maybe not. So we built in kind of a safeguard where when someone starts the simulation, no one else can go in and go through it and start clicking on things and mess that person's simulation up. The other thing was the nurse anesthesia program, they're very busy students, and they spend a lot of their time working, and it's very hard to meet with the faculty because the faculty actually go into the OR at KU Medical Center and are in the real-life operating room all the time. And so that was a problem that we had to also look at as well. Do you want to do this?
All right, I think Stephanie's voice is finally given out on here. We had five different object types we ended up with, and this really made development of the simulation a lot easier. One of the decisions we had to make, were we going to have smart objects or dumb objects? So was the code primarily going to be in the individual objects like the laryngoscope or the pulse oximeter, or was it going to be in some major controller routine? And we kind of did a split on there. What we ended up doing is, by having a main controller that they start the simulation, we record which avatar clicked on it, and we don't allow anybody else to go in, and or they can actually click on things, but the objects won't respond to them. So we had a smart controller in that regard, and it's what actually records what all's getting clicked on and eventually emails the steps to the instructor. Then the instructor evaluates whether or not the student did things in the correct order. We tried to initially do that in Second Life. No, it's too complicated. There's too many possible combinations that are still correct, and it would take an expert nurse, anesthetist to really decide, did this student perform correctly or not. So the main controller, and a little picture of it when we do the simulation, we'll show you that. We had what we called primary objects, and those were the ones that the students saw when they were actually in the operating room. And this one over here has a little bit of text above it that we used for visual cues. It says, attach face mask. So you can have text float over objects in Second Life. And that gave them some visual cues about functionality. If I click on this, this is what it's going to do. When you click on the face mask, it's going to attach the face mask. And so that primary object, when it gets clicked on, it interacts with what we called secondary objects. And the secondary objects were transparent. So they were actually attached. And that's that middle slide there. You can see kind of an outline of it, but it's transparent. The user can't see it. And all the primary and secondary objects do is when you click on the primary one, it sends a message that it was clicked on, and the secondary object just listens for that message. As soon as it hears it, it goes from transparent to being visible, and the other one goes transparent. So it gives the appearance of moving. We tried all kinds of things, moving it in and positioning it, but as soon as you move anything else in the operating room, you have to move all the other objects as well. So that's the approach that we took. We had primary and secondary objects, and then all the main controller is doing is just listening to the primary and secondary objects. They can chat with each other on a private channel, and they're just telling everybody the oximeter got clicked on or face mask got clicked on, and date and time when that happened. Then we had, as it got more complicated, we had tertiary objects, so they only respond to the primary or secondary. So when you click on the oximeter on the IV pole, it disappears. The one on their finger shows up, so they get some feedback. They actually clicked on it. But then what would happen in real life is on the screen, they would start to get a pulse, and they would see what the oxygen level was in the patient. So we put that up there. So it just listens for the correct primary object to say it was clicked on, or the secondary object to say it was removed, and then it responds to that. And then there were some background objects that you'll see some of these in here just to add realism. So we have a biohazards disposal and cabinets and those kind of things that were very easy to make, but they don't really, I wouldn't say they're not functional at all, but they do, they provide some visual as to how the room would actually be laid out, but they're not scripted in any way. So those are the primary ones. And if you were going to do a similar thing, you'd have a main controller that was running the whole show, but you'd have smart primary and secondary and tertiary objects and then background objects. Are you okay?
Good enough. Okay, because
she can do the simulation much better than I can.
All right. Sorry about that. So here's a little picture of our island. And actually, I think we have Second Life open. All right. So here's Rain. And we're on the island. Whoops. And we have various projects going on around the island. But what I'm going to do is go into this very empty hospital. We have a lot of plans for it, but right now just the operating room is in here. So the operating room is on the second floor up here. Okay, so as you can see, we have a lot of pictures. That we took from the operating room. And when the students actually came in here, they were very impressed with how it looked and how similar it was. So, first of all, I'm going to take you through just a few of the first steps. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but one of the things is this H&P, the history and physical. And what that does, it just gives them a note card with all the information that they need about the patient. So like name, age, weight, height. A lot of these other things that I don't even really know what they mean. But a lot of these help with knowledge of what decisions they need to make later. So they have that. And here's the patient, Alfred here. Another thing is they really need to know how to zoom in and out and look around. So what they would do is go in here and click to begin. And that changes so it knows that just rain can touch these other things. And basically they would go through and they would do, okay, let's attach the pulse oximeter. And when that happens, the pulse line and the pulse number is up here, and it also has attached to the patient's hand. If they want to attach the blood pressure cuff, that would go on there. And then they would have to know that they need to press the start-stop button here to make this screen show this up here. They could attach the face mask, and that goes over there. And you'll notice these are the cues that we give them to know that they have done specific items. And the other thing is if they want to attach the 5-lead EKG, then they would click this. And they are asked which color would you like to attach. And you'll also notice that on the body, these 5 spots are kind of highlighted. So let's say I want the brown, and I click on that, and okay, that was the brown one, so there we go. And then they'd have to go back and click all these others. So on and so forth. And I set this up so I can quickly click on these to show you guys. So now the EKG has been attached. And then here are the inhalation agents, the drugs. And that's what they do, and it shows down here that they've administered the induction agent. And they'd go through the steps, and then when they're finished, they would click here. And if you noticed, all of the items went back to where their original state. And what it's doing is it is emailing the instructor the steps that they've taken. So there it goes. Simulation ended by rain. So what happens is the instructor gets something like this in their email. So it kind of shows the exact steps that they did to to get through the simulation. And the instructor would be the person who would know whether if they attached the face mask before the EKG, whether that was correct or not, which it was. They could do, things out of order, which are okay, but other things are not okay to be out of order, so then the instructor would know exactly what kind of grade they can give them or how they did.
Okay, before we got too far into the simulation, we thought it'd be a good idea to run some real nurse anesthesia students through to make sure that what we thought was the process and made sense, being Second Life users, made sense to them. So we did some usability testing. We had lots of questions that we wanted to look for. Were the objects too small you know, how small the pulse oximeter was on there. We were giving feedback to the students. You might have noticed when they clicked on the objects, they turned red for just a few seconds, and then they actually attached, and you got the text feedback on there. So lots of different questions that we had. Was it realistic enough they could recognize the objects? Was the functionality in there that they could anticipate that they would need to do things? For example, all you have to do is click on the pulse oximeter and it attaches, but on the blood pressure cuff, you have to click on it to attach it and click on the monitor, the start button on the monitor, because that's what you have to do in real life on there. So would they know, did we give them enough cues, build a realistic enough simulation that would be apparent to them? So what we did is we brought in four students, actually the department head rounded them up, and they were all male, which is unusual for nursing, and nurse anesthesia even, it's about 50-50 on there. So we had no choice over that. That's who was sent us. We were lucky to get those four, so we decided to make the most of it. Two were juniors and two were seniors. So we wanted the juniors represented, best represented who the target audience would be. And so these would be the typical students that we would have go through. We also wanted two seniors. They knew the process and the induction process, could do it in their sleep and do all kinds of variations and respond to it. So anything they got wrong most likely was because something we did in the simulation didn't make sense to them. The interface got in the way on there. So we included those. Just happened that three of them were gamers, and only one was a non-gamer on there. So they picked up very quickly on how to use Second Life, and we're doing all kinds of things. I think two of them probably already have accounts and are playing around now with it. We used existing Second Life accounts, so for the usability testing, so they didn't have to go in and register and set up their avatar and, you know, worry about how their hair looked and all that other stuff that's not important. They're very busy people. They're in the clinic 8 to 10 hours a day, and they have class on top of that. So these folks are very busy. Plus, they're all registered nurses. They could be making great money working, but they're going to school for 2 years. They don't want to mess around with what does their hair look like on there. We did a real brave Second Life training. Sometimes I think people, because the instructor is so infatuated with Second Life, they want to show them everything about Second Life and all this stuff. They don't care about the economy. They don't care about vehicles and dancing and all that other stuff. There's just a very few things they need to know to be able to do our simulation. They need to know how to move around. They need to know how to focus and zoom, and that when you click on objects, it does things. So Stephanie presented about 10 minutes worth of training to them. They picked up on it very quickly, even the non-gamer. The gamers had it almost instantly on there. We're playing around doing all kinds of other things. So we gave them a brief simulation demonstration, pretty much what we showed you. And Stephanie was doing it. I was watching their faces, and you could just see these kind of click in their minds, like the EKG things. Oh, yeah, I can see how that would work. So we got a lot of feedback that what we were doing made sense to them. And then we just again, just tested the first 8 steps of the procedure. And Stephanie and I both observed them, and we asked them to think aloud as they were doing things. So, you know, I think I'm supposed to attach the face mask, and so I click on the face mask. Does it do what they thought it would do? So pretty typical usability testing procedure with all its limitations and flaws that go along with it. Some of the findings that came up in here, just as we thought moving and viewing training was very important, so that's something we're going to emphasize in future uses or future training. If they can't move around and zoom to look on the objects they need to look at, by zoom I mean to be able to focus on the object and enlarge it on the screen. They would have difficulty with the simulation. It turns out the small target objects were not difficult. They had mastered how to focus and zoom on things, and so they quickly recognized them because of the other context that they were placed in. We did come up with a problem with the transparent objects. If an object's transparent, a user can't see it, but they can still click on it. And so one patient was trying to attach the leads, and he could see the place, but he was clicking in the face mask. He couldn't see the face mask, but it was in the way. And we knew that, and eventually changed his view and clicked from a different angle. So we have some ideas of things we're going to do differently on that. My son's been playing Second Life since he was 13. He's a great scripter, makes incredible weapons too, sells those in Second Life on the Teen Grid. And he said, well, Dad, just make the objects smaller. I'm like, oh, okay, you can script them to small and transparent, and then we can enlarge them when we need to. So that'll be probably the approach that we take on that. Then the simulation functionality was not always clear. The one that I noticed that most on was the blood pressure cuff. They clicked on it and attached it, but then got doing other things. They didn't remember they needed to click on the start button. But what was interesting is the two of them that did that noticed quickly when they looked at the screen that they didn't have the information on the screen they needed, and they didn't even zoom on the screen. They knew where to click on that panel where the start button was to get it to come up. So it was kind of interesting that it wasn't clear, and yet they seemed to have figured it out. And then other thing is all four of the participants were really enthusiastic about it and saw some real positive educational potential for it. So how are we doing on time? 10 minutes. All right. Couple things. This is great if you happen to teach nurse students or doctors that want to see this, or beginning nurses who want to know what's going on, but you probably don't teach classes like that. Maybe some of you do. So how could you use this for what you do? You basically look at it and say, this is a way of learning complex physical procedures. There's some procedures are very simple, two or three steps. You don't need to do this. This is a very complex procedure. There's lots of decision points, many steps, many places for mistakes. And mistakes in the operating room means people feel pain, people get injured, people die. So we can't have those kind of mistakes in the operating room. So some of the things you may do that might translate, and maybe ask for some of your input on here, assembly of equipment. So you're not necessarily learning how to insert the tube and turn it, but you know that at this point the tube needs to be inserted, so you're trying to teach them, click on the tube, that's the next step in the assembly process. Calibration, some equipment have very complex calibration procedures need to go through. Again, they're not using the equipment because maybe it's very expensive to use, or you don't want them to play around with the real stuff in case they break it. So you could teach them, here's the calibration process. You need to click on this button, turn this dial, check the output, turn the dial again on there. And then one thing we plan to do in future iterations, once we get the basic process done, are some emergency responses. What happens when a patient goes into a condition, I think they call hypothermia, where things don't turn out the way they should. Does the nurse anesthetist knows how to respond to that? Or maybe they're running a nuclear power plant and something happens. Do they know the procedure, what they need to do, what they need to look at? So it's basically teaching them the procedure itself, not necessarily working on the equipment, but gives them a lot of feedback about how that works. I guess before I go on, I'm interested if people in the room also teach complex physical processes as part of their class, and if there's some ideas that you might have for your class that this fits in, because those are just three that we came up with. Okay, so I'm supposed to repeat the question for the recording part. So yes, could you have other students in there and possibly the instructor to actually critique as they went through? And yeah, you could do that, sure, on there. Yes, men are back. Sure. I guess application was differential diagnosis. When your patient goes in, presents certain symptoms, there's a certain procedure you go through to diagnose what's wrong with them. Possibly could script that. And currently we use actors and things like that to do some of that, which is expensive. Yes. I think they gave us the list of what this patient was going to have, and they presented it in a note card to them.
Oh, okay.
And we didn't quite understand all the complexities of it. One important part of it was if, let's say, the patient was being operated on the right arm, obviously you can't attach the blood pressure cuff and the oximeter on that. So they had some decisions they had to make, where the leads would go, depending on if they were having surgery in their chest. So there's a lot of complexity. We didn't understand that the students taught us on that. Any other things you can think of that might be applications of this in your field? Lady in the back, did you have a... Yes. We use it for other projects, but not this one. The multi-user actually got in the way. You know, how do we keep people out from messing around with the simulation? And so we used it because we had it already available. We already knew how to use it. Island was there, fairly cheap, easy. Probably could have got some other server, a more closed system, but we already had this. Okay. A couple reasons why we think it works, primarily because it can help reduce the cognitive load. You have a very complicated procedure. Each one of those steps is also very... could be a very complicated procedure within it. And so we're teaching them what I would call the executive routine. It's Gagne's old psychomotor skills piece. So you go through and you know what to do at each of the steps. And each of the steps, of course, is more complex than just that. So we think by learning that executive routine first, it helps the students then when they actually have to go in and do the particular things. And the other one is that you may need a tactile supplement, so they do actually know how to stick that nasty thing down your throat so they can stick a tube in there. They need to know how to actually physically do that, and people have long jaws and long necks and short necks, and there's lots of variations, so they will need some practice actually doing that that our simulation won't do. It's just to teach the procedure itself. Okay, so... we'll leave this open for question time. I think we should have a few minutes. Our contact information is here. We've got some business cards also.
Why did you decide to put floating text over the objects rather than having students have to recognize the objects and know
what to do? So that it had to do with the functionality component. How do they know that there's... certain objects are actually scripted to do things. So clicking on the drawer or the cabinet wasn't important, and having the drawer open. It primarily was a visual cue. We didn't tell them the order, which was important, but simply that somewhere along that line, that object had action associated with it. And I'm sorry, I didn't repeat the question. Is why did we put floating text above the objects? And that was the answer for that. Gentleman in the back. So the question was, can we make it so they have to do them in a particular order? The object won't react until it's in the correct order. We could do that, but we didn't, because that's in real life. They can turn on the induction agent anytime they want to. Until they have it set up correctly, it's not going to have the effect in there. So yes, it could be. Yes, ma'am.
What's your development time from the inception to the finished product?
And
how many persons were involved?
Can I do that one better? How much time you spent? And you can't talk? All right. Steph's voice is going out. We were learning a lot as we went along, so that made it difficult. Plus, we had a transition that occurred. The director left for medical reasons. I took over as director, which left my position open. Steph came into my position, which left her old position open. So we had some changeover and training and things in there. If I had to make a guess, once we had the basic concept put together, the main controller and the smart objects, we wrote the script for it. Once we had that part done, it would probably be about an hour an object, I would say, between building the object. If we had a good photograph, if we had a crooked photograph, because I took the pictures usually, or an out-of-focus photograph, we had to do some touch-up. But if we had a good photograph to build the object and insert the code, make some really minor modifications to the code. We really wrote it so that it would be portable to the other objects. Probably about an hour an object, I would say. Now we could do that. And the cool thing about the simulation is we can just keep adding objects because the controller, all it does is listen on a channel for the object to say it was clicked on. Yes?
What kind of technical skills do you need to build the object?
Photoshop's good. Kind of a visual arts graphic design flair is useful. on there. So that would explain why I don't build things. They'd all be boxes. And so those are probably good for building a part. Scripting, I have programming background, so it was pretty quick for me to pick up, and Steph has some scripting background as well. Hang on a second. Steph says also 3D is useful, some 3D practice.
Yeah, 3D simulation.
Okay.
In
Second Life, they have a built-in language, Linden scripting language, pretty similar to C on there. Other questions over here?
How did you manage multiple users? Was there a sign-up sheet for time slots for the simulation?
With the students themselves, we missed their deadline because of some of the things going on, so we didn't get to use the students, the first-year students, the junior students coming in, but that would be up to the instructor to decide who's going to go in when. We thought we'd just leave it open and they could go in anytime they wanted to practice, and that's what the students in the usability study thought was a good idea as well.
Yes. We're
out of time. We're the last presentation anyway. AJ is doing a Second Life users group, virtual world constituency group upstairs, I think, like almost directly over this room, I think in 330 D, so you're welcome to go to that, or you can stick around and we can continue to answer questions.
This EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference podcast is sponsored by Real Networks. Outsourced hosting of multi-format digital media content is available from Real's own CDN, the Real Broadcast Network. Information at rbn.com.